hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Welcome back to Hamster with a Blunt Pen Knife, the Doctor Who commentary podcast. I am here today with a gentleman that I don't think anybody of this audience will be a stranger to, Mr. Simon Moore. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Joe?
Oh, it's early for me. It's late for you.
It is late for me. It's yes, it's evening. Yes, the perils of living on the other side of the world. But, you know, we get by.
Now, you are what I consider to be one of the alumni of the most prestigious Doctor Who podcast, because you appear frequently on Flight for Entirety. How did that come about?
I do. Well, I appear frequently, but I'm a latecomer. I'm far from the original crowd. But I've known the guys at FTE for, well, most of my adult life. And so it was only natural that at some time, that at some stage, they would open up the thing and allow me to express my displeasure at all the things that they've been saying for the previous episodes.
But you know, and that's what my role is. Love you for that, because I'll tell you what, right, a lot of people come onto that show, and this is why I got in touch with you. I listened to Dark Water and I'm like, yes, is that dissenting voice? Because I'll tell you what, to stand up to Nathan Bottomley and say, do you know what, I think you're wrong, is it's a bold thing to do, and you do it well.
Well, you know, I have to fill that role, so hopefully it goes okay.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted you're here today. Why don't you tell everybody what we're going to talk about?
Well, we're going to talk about a story which I absolutely love and adore and have done so since I was a wee small thing, and that is Terror of the Zygons. And I don't want to make all those British listeners of a certain era jealous, but of course, you know, we used to have what you might describe as endless repeats in Australia, certainly when I was growing up in the early 80s. And yes, exactly. Thank you. But certainly Terror of the Zygons was something that I would always look forward to every time we came back round to basically the Tom Baker, the Hinchcliffe era, basically. And this was a story which stood out as something that I absolutely love. And I still think to this day, as a piece of television, it really stands up. CGI, shmigi, as far as I can say, it is spectacular.
You know, I have heard that on good authority as well, that they are redoing the Scarisan effects for the Blu-ray that's going to come out. But, you know, I rather like the stop motion animation in this.
Well, it's not surprising that, look, I have a troubled thing with the updated effects. I mean, I think they're interesting to do, and I think, well, why not? If you're going to release it on DVD and Blu-ray and so on, of course you're going to do that. But it kind of jars for me with the original program. It's never quite marries, and so you smudge your eyes, you don't look at it too closely, and yeah, okay, it was done in 1975, but look how great it was for that era, for the fact that they did it on a shoestring. And so I think that the efforts to update it, whilst well-meaning, I don't feel the need to watch those versions.
Well, you and I were talking just a little off mic about how there's a scene in this that was excised for the broadcast version and then wound its way back in for the DVD release, and how jarring it is because it's so ingrained in your head, the order of the scenes and how these stories flow. Like I came to a lot of these Hinchcliffe stories because they came out on VHS, you know, the unedited versions with no cliffhangers in them at all. So now they were brought out on VHS with no cliffhangers, loads of scenes taken out of them. And those are the ones I watched 100 times when I was a kid. So now when I watch the Blu-ray, I'm like, what the hell is this cliffhanger in the middle of this story?
This tense moment. Yes, exactly. It is very strange. It's funny. We didn't get, I mean, we had a various times the ABC would show them in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways, but Terror of the Zygons for some reason never got that treatment. It was always in episodes. It was more the kind of the Graham Williams stuff that we got to see in subsequent repeats as Saturday afternoon omnibuses. But so they're the ones that I kind of associate with not having cliffhangers, but it's so great to have the cliffhangers in this. It's just part of the story.
Especially when they're this good as well.
Exactly.
Episode one. Oh, we'll get there. Well, then, before we go into the first episode, can I just ask you your thoughts on the Hinchcliffe era as a whole? Like, is this a favourite of yours?
It is. I mean, look, I don't want to be certainly when I was a sort of fan in the late 80s, you know, you try to sort of say, well, look, Hinchcliffe era was just a part of the rest of the show, and all parts of the show have their merits and so on and so on. And yes, obviously they do. And there are parts of all eras of the program that I really love. But it has to be for me the Pertwee era and the Hinchcliffe era are Doctor Who at its best. It's where everything is working. It's where I think everyone's taking it seriously. I think where comparatively speaking, there is money there, as much money as there ever was before, kind of, you know, inflation took off in the late 70s and all the rest of it, and before some of the excesses of the JNT era kind of came in. So this, for me, this year, these 3 years, and season 13 as well. I mean, a lot of people kind of talk about season 13 as the lesser of the three Hinchcliffe years, but for me, it is the second best, if not the best. There are so many parts of it that I love. This, Seeds of Doom, Pyramids of Mars, Android Invasion, which I know doesn't get much love, but I absolutely love that story. It's what I want Doctor Who to be. And yes, that's probably the 10-year-old me saying it when I've, you know, we've just had season 17 shown for the first time, and then we go back to Ark in Space and kind of keep going from there. So I'm doing that direct comparison, but yeah, it's just magical.
Android Invasion, you know, is my partner's favorite Doctor Who story. And I have a great affection for it because the way I romanced him was to take him to Didcot and have him tie me to that thing in the middle of the village. It means a
Right.
great deal to me, Android Invasion. It never used
Well,
to, but it does now.
I'm sure being tied to that war memorial has its own special place for you. But saying it's the favorite story is probably going a little bit too far.
Oh, Simon, the rest of them, his other favorites are The Chase. You know, you
Oh
pick
dear
a
God,
Planet of the
no.
Daleks. Like, he is a singularly unique Doctor Who fan, and I love him for that.
Fair enough. It
Well,
takes
look,
all sorts.
it really does. Shall we pop into episode one and see
I
what
think we
Terror of the
probably
Zygons
should.
has to offer us?
I think we probably should.
I'll count us in then. In 5, 4,
Yep.
3, 2, 1. You done a
And
commentary
we're
before?
away. I've never done a commentary
Oh,
before. I'm a
great.
commentary virgin.
Virgin territory.
It is. I've only talked about an episode after seeing it, not whilst I'm watching it. So forgive me for accidentally sort of falling silent to watch this fantastic story.
I don't think that's going to be a problem with you, do you know?
But I mean, these credits are part of what I was saying before about the classic nature of the classic show. And I think that the credits has always been something that I've been disappointed by as a whole with the new series, generally speaking, which sounds strange, but you know, that's me. But look at that model shot of
Oh,
the
it's
opening. I mean, obviously it's a
great.
model, but it looks so detailed. I mean, there is a lot of love in that model. Now, probably, you know, that they had that model sort of sitting somewhere because they've got, you know, in the BBC they had, you know, models of oil refineries just waiting to be, not oil refineries, oil rigs rather, to waiting to be used for something, but it's still pretty great.
You've only got to compare it to how the oil rig was shot in Power of Krull to see how badly these things can go wrong and
Oh,
how
absolutely.
expertly this is done in this story.
Absolutely. Now, do you know who this bloke is? Where we've seen this bloke before? The
Go
guy,
on.
he is Osgood in the Seeds of Death.
Is he?
He is. So the guy who gets killed in episode one. But
Oh,
it's
do you know,
funny
I'm
because, of course,
terrible at this game. People
I
think
didn't
this of me
see
all the
I,
time.
but I didn't see that till years later because of the fact that, you know, that wasn't we never got the Pertwees, the Troughtons and Hartnells and so on during the repeats, the endless repeats that we got. So it was only subsequently that I recognized him in Seeds of Death and went, oh my God, that's the same bloke. Anyway, even that destruction of the oil rig. Now look at this. See, this is where it's supposed to start. This is supposed to be where you first see the Doctor and Sarah and Harry, and these are the this is the pinnacle team for me. It was always the Doctor, Sarah, and Harry that I loved going back and seeing. And it's just so sweet the way, you know, Harry's wearing the Doctor's scarf, they're striding across the moor. And don't you think Elizabeth Sladen's outfit in this story is just probably one of her best? This
Gorgeous.
jumpsuit.
Yeah. And the hat, I just like the fact that they're all wearing part of his costume. They feel like the best of
Oh, yes,
friends.
she's. Yeah, exactly. And
And the
an old crappy
music in this
car.
scene as well, it eases you in beautifully.
Yes, the music. And that's the music. I mean, much as I have every respect for Dudley Simpson, and back in the days of conventions, I did interview him, and you know, as a musician, I have every respect for him. Likewise, similarly for Murray Gold. But I think, like Murray Gold, the issue with Dudley is that it's all Dudley. Like, there's so much Dudley Simpson that I think he's overused. And by the time you get to the Williams era, it starts to get stale and maybe not quite what the visuals are demanding. And isn't John Woodrat fantastic there? Just in that one line, he gets across his contempt for...
He tells. I don't know if you watched the documentary before watching this, but he tells some wonderful stories about this. He goes, "Oh, Douglas Canfield phoned him up and said, right, he goes, I've got a role for you. You're going to play this big sucky alien and you're going to play a Duke and you're going to play the alien playing the Duke. And he said, Dougie, I'll do anything for you. Anything.
Fantastic.
Oh, you think they could possibly be in Scotland, given that the first scene featured a man saying Willie and could you nose send over a few wee haggis?
they're shorthanded. There's kind of racial stereotyping or whatever the right expression is.
I say the Brigadier looks mighty fine in a kilt, though. We haven't seen it yet, but we're about to.
We haven't seen it yet. But it's funny because, I mean, I know that they did each other Pertwee's like before I started watching Doctor Who, and then subsequently, like, they went back and showed all the Pertwee's through. But for me, it was mainly the Hinchcliffe era, like in that kind of formative years, if I can describe that. So this older Brigadier, the older Brigadier that you see in Robot and this is the one that I remember. So he always feels like, looks like he's a child when I see him now in the Pertwee era. Likewise, Benton.
I think Janet Fielden felt the same way when she was watching season 8 on the Blu-rays or behind the sofa, and she went, look at Nick. He looks like a baby. Yes. Like, bless him.
Yes.
In fact, he looks great in that tam o'shanter as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. But look at that lens. Look at the fact that, like, I mean, Douglas Canfield is such a strong director. I mean, look at the fact that he's that's shot on a long lens, and so everyone there's a narrow depth of field, and so it looks like they're being viewed from afar. And I think a lesser director, it would just be a plain shot. And it's those kind of things which help create space, in direction.
Well, and just as well, just that whole thing of looking out of a window like that and then cutting into the set. Like, you don't even get that level of thought usually in some Doctor Who stories.
No. But again, I mean, you've got the studio and you've got the location and they're shot weeks apart and shot huge, vast distances apart. And yet marrying it together in that way, I think takes care.
Whilst we're talking about production detail, I'm going to mention something I've got a bit of a fetish with Doctor Who, because you don't see them very often. And that is, that set has a ceiling, okay? And you don't...
So it does.
You so rarely see a ceiling in Doctor Who. And the designer says he had a massive battle with the lighting technician. It was like, you've got to take the ceiling out. I can't light the scene. He goes, well, I don't care. For once, we're going to not have a free-walled, you know, theatre set for Doctor Who. We're going to actually make it feel as if we're genuinely inside this inn. It looks great.
It does.
And there's lots of detail in the set there. Just the bar behind them. It feels like a lived-in space.
A lived-in space. But I'm just thinking about it then, as you were saying that, how small that space actually is. Mm. Like, that is that is probably about 3 meters by 2 meters, a bit more, but no more than that. It is quite a tiny space. And yes, you're right, the ceiling, or at least a little bit of ceiling there. And because, of course, all those pubs, all those, you know, older buildings in Britain and in Scotland, they're all, you know,
there's one down the road.
The ceilings are quite low. And so in some respects, it would look weird if you didn't see the ceiling in the shot. And look at that. Yes, you can see it above the boar's head sign.
Oh, boy. Wow, these scenes on the... Oh. Another thing Doctor Who doesn't do enough is go to the beach. And when
I wouldn't call this a beach, I'd call this a mud flat. But yes,
we're not having the UK Australia divide on beaches on this, okay? I've tempted enough Australians to Eastbourne. we're going to cut back to it quite a bit in the next couple of scenes, but the way those scenes are shot, they would not look out of place in a Hammer movie in the 70s, like a bigger budget Hammer movie.
No, exactly. But you see how they're all taking it completely seriously. Like, you know, even though they're talking nonsense, they're all performing it as if it's high drama, as if it's, like, you know, prestigious BBC drama. And going back to what you were saying at the set, I mean, this is why I think doing these kind of stories in these kind of settings is so perfect for the programme with that limited budget, because there'd have been so much of this that just comes from stock. So much of the set is just available to be used, whether it's filing cabinets here in this scene now with Huckle, or the office, the pub, all the things that make the pub look so lived in, as you were talking about before, and and, you know, real is because of the fact that they've got that set from something else, God knows what, but it's there.
I always feel like 72 does cozy well. Like What's-Her-Face's cottage in Stones of Blood and things like that. They do those sort of domestic cozy settings really well.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of clutter and lived in, yeah. But look at this. I mean, this sequence in Huckle's office and that shot just then with Harry and Sarah and walking off. Everything's so tight. There are no I haven't really seen a proper wide shot yet. And I don't think that's necessarily because the set's microscopic. I think it's just partly because Douglas Camfield just knows.
It's for the drama.
Exactly. I've often said that Doctor Who, the good Doctor Who directors back in the classic era, the better directors knew how to shoot it. And Douglas Camfield is shooting it like it's a traditional drama rather than trying to shoot it like it's a science fiction program.
Yeah.
I mean, it helps, obviously, the fact that it's in an oil refinery, oil rig and, you know, offices and things.
And then you marry that with Robert Banks Stewart, who is quoted as saying he didn't want to write a science fiction story. He wanted to write a contemporary thriller set on Earth. So you bring in a director that's doing that. You bring in a writer that's doing that. Suddenly, we're almost not watching Doctor Who anymore. We're watching a sort of fabulous folk horror.
Exactly. And it tricks you into thinking that. And I think, again, that's why I love this era. Now, this guy, Angus McRandall, was it Angus McRandall the character's name?
That's right, yeah.
He's in the Great Escape film that I didn't realize. And isn't he also in The Dice Warriors, or am I getting
Penley's mate, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, hilarious. But he's in The Great Escape in a kind of a minor role. And I remember, because that was kind of the kind of film that was on once a year, you know, at this time, and you sit down and watch it all the time.
You know how sort of Burke Kwok always ends up being the stock Chinese character in things? Angus Lenny, inevitably in the 70s, turns out to be your stock Scottish character.
Yes.
Because he does it so well, though.
Call Angus, yes, exactly. Yeah. It's lovely. But isn't Sarah great here? I mean, Sarah's doing her job as an investigative journalist.
Yes. And you know what? We push away from that after this, I think. I don't think we see it again for the rest of her run. It was there very prevalent in the series season 11. And then we had her doing it in Robot. She does it again here. And then we don't really spend a lot of time on Earth after this.
Exactly. It only really works when she's on Earth. I mean, kind of works when she's in Android Invasion as well, sort of for the same reason.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
Our aforementioned story. Now, can I just say that here we are with the Zygons appearing with all we see is the eyes at first. You see the hands on the console. And it's all organic and, you know, squidgy and so on. And much as I actually do like, we've just done the Zygon invasion two-parter for FTE, and much as I love, I think it's a great set of episodes, there's something about the way the Zygons are presented in the modern era which doesn't match what we see here, which is ridiculous given that this is, you know, they're filmed 30 years apart. You'd think that they'd be able to recreate the Zygons in a more organic. It's the moisture.
It is exactly that. I feel as if they've been squirted down here, whereas in Invasion Inversion, they just feel like rubber costumes.
Yeah, they're a rubber monster, and that's what's missing. It's very sad. It's very unfortunate, I should say.
Which is a shame, because the transformations and things they can do come Capaldi's time is amazing.
Exactly.
Oh, I love all of this, the sort of the folklore. He went walking out on the mists, you know.
Off his head, yes. I won't try and do the accent.
But the way Liz Hayden just punctuates it completely and goes, maybe, but I know evil spirits don't destroy all rigs.
Exactly. She's great. But she's listening. Look at that. She's really listening. But also, it's almost like, I mean, the actress is good enough that she's sort of looking at him going, I'm trying to make sure that he doesn't look like it. I don't look like I don't believe a word he's saying. But then he kind of gives it to him like, evil spirits don't destroy your rigs. God, that would have been cold.
Very cold.
In that water.
I can tell you now with some confidence, because I live by the sea, that the only time you can go into a British sea is the last week of August. That's it. And even then, it's still cold. That shot there, look at him silhouetted against the sun.
Isn't that great? And the sun reflecting on the water and just the waves coming in. And the music. Can we talk again about the music? I mean, and this, the cave are coming up. But it just because the music is so perfect here, because these shots, the way Camfield's shooting it, it's so lonely. Those long shots now, looking at whatever the character's name is, Osgood from the Seat of Death, walking up there. it's so lonely. It's isolated. You get a real sense that there is nobody within Kui, and it's just so powerful.
And in the same breath, in the music, there's like an ominous beat playing throughout this as well, where you're like, something terrible is going to happen here.
Yeah.
I don't think, I do love Dudley's music, but I don't think it warns you in this way. It doesn't suggest terrible things in this way.
And this shot here we're about to get now with Harry, and then it goes over the, oh no, it's a different one I'm thinking of, but there's a shot where it goes over where they're running over the camera, and it's just, it's a classic, typical shot. Like, none of Canfield's shots are unique. They're all the standard directorial repertoire, but they are all so well placed and well chosen.
I think he's well edited as well, in a way some Doctor Who's aren't.
Yes, exactly.
So he's like, oh, cut it there. We want this sense of movement, you know?
Exactly.
Oh, bless him.
Smash the rig to pieces. Yeah, taking it seriously. And this gunshot here, just wait for the gunshot where the caber fires twice.
And the music stops. Builds and builds, doesn't it?
And stops for the first gunshot. Then there's silence for the second gunshot. And then all you get is the sound of the caber, you know, doing whatever it is to the rifle. And then Harry's
very unusual appearance of blood as well.
Very unusual appearance of blood. But the point is, it's using sound properly. You've got the music building, but then you use the lack of music to punctuate it. And I think, again, I'm not convinced, bless him, but I'm not convinced Dudley would do something like that. There'd be some kind of timpanis and things going off.
I don't know if you ever remember when Cordo got shot in Brain of Morbius, he started playing some sort of comedy music as the blood splattered. You know,
it's practically comedy music. I mean, which doesn't help the fact that it is slightly comical to have this blood spurting out. It's over the top.
I'm perfectly convinced that is a comedy, though. Yeah. Do you know?
Yeah.
Flowers of the Forest, a lament for the dead.
For the dead. Yes.
Nobody can do Tom Baker like Tom Baker, can they?
No, I mean that voice.
Oh, the way she mocks
and this
him
one
as
his
well.
Dad gets jammed too, and the look that is just so great. And this is the best. Hello, Fox.
Oh, can I tell you, right? At work, every time I pick up the phone, I'm always saying this. Like, what the hell does that mean? Oh, you never.
and yet,
technology.
Harry's been shot. Yes. I mean, it's all just nonsense now. Diastatic reading 703, increase the sonic core tone.
But it looks great.
It looks fantastic and it sounds fantastic.
Don't tell me every time you have a pepperoni pizza, you're not convinced to twiddle those bits of pepperoni, all right?
Hell yes.
Yeah, and the way Canfield, and I know this is an obvious thing to say because a lot of people do it in Doctor Who, the way he builds up the monster by showing the eyes, the hands, and then at the end of the episode, we see the full creature. I don't think it's done as masterfully as it is here anywhere else.
That's correct, yeah. Some ocean.
I'm so used to people not agreeing with me, you know. Thank you very much.
Have we had the "it may be calm, but it is never empty"?
I think we have.
That was a shame I didn't pick that up. But that is just brilliant. And especially because it's so closely mic'd to that moment as well.
And we had the bit where he's in a terribly foul mood and goes, "Oil and emergency, ha!"
Yes.
By all accounts, I think Tom Baker, Nick Courtney said Tom Baker weren't in a great mood when filming this. I can tell.
Really?
Yeah.
It's interesting because usually you can tell when he's in a bad mood, but maybe he's just it's still early on, so he's focusing the bad mood rather than letting the bad mood become visible.
I wonder though, there was a bit of anxiety from Nick Courtney and John Levine knowing kind of they're on their way out as well.
Yeah, well...
I don't think Tom Baker made any secret of the fact that he wasn't interested in unit stories and that sort of thing.
Well, it's not really up to Tom. It's Philip Hinchcliffe deciding that. But the thing is, I mean, of course, we have to remember this is filmed as the last story of season 12. And I believe it's only because they decided to start the next season in September rather than January that they held this over, right? Is that I'm right there?
That's
there,
right. Yeah. They said that Space 1999... was coming, and so they wanted to bring out the next season earlier, so they basically made a dent in 1999. And I think 1999 dented them for one episode, and then everyone came back to Doctor Who after that.
Quite right
Yeah, it's fun, but it ain't no season 13.
It is no season 13.
Oh, can we please talk about Sister Lamont?
Sister
please?
Lamont,
who just in my childhood,
chilling.
She terrified me as a kid.
Yeah, yeah. It's our Nurse Ratched, basically, because it's around the same time. I mean, she must be. When's Cuckoo's Nest come out?
Oh,
it must be around this time.
Louise Fletcher in that, though. Jeez Louise.
Exactly. And you'd have to think that she's got Louise Fletcher on her mind with this performance. Or at least when they cast her, they're thinking of the Nurse Ratched figure.
I just had those words. Don't worry, Dr. Sullivan. You're going to be very well taken care of in my head. Oh, man. And that's for the bit with the blood later, but we'll get there.
Yeah. Oh, yes, in the forest, yes.
Well, Tommy's literally flying now. In a minute, he does his bit, doesn't he? Teeth. The scientific teeth, yes.
Yes.
Says the man with the most incredible teeth on television right now.
In that era, certainly. Here we go. Yes. Paris. And he's really... I mean, this is the thing. I keep coming back to the fact that everyone's taking it deadly seriously. It is a piece of drama, right? There's humour in the script from time to time, which is brought out, but there's no... there's no hamming. There's no kind of, you know, hamming it up because, oh, this is a bit that's stupid, so let's treat it stupidly, you know.
Which would creep in later, Tom.
Exactly.
I mean, look at him there. He's the most scary thing in the story.
Look at that, the way he is, as paper. Intense. And the way he says easily as paper. You know, oh, just that voice.
I was learning words as well when I was watching. I didn't know molars before this. Doctor Who taught me a ton of words.
You weren't going to the dentist enough, obviously.
No, look at my teeth. It's terrible. Honestly. Oh, and that was another image that really frightened me as a kid, that close up on the eyes.
Oh, yes, here we go. But so what's your first encounter with this story then? Was it on a repeat or something?
No, I had the VHS. My mate pulled down the road
VHS. Oh, this is the Omnibus VHS, yes.
And he lent it to me, and I can vividly recall watching this one. I'm not taking a piss, myself, at my mother's knee. She was asleep on the chair. And by the end of episode one, I was hugging her knee. I was terrified. I would have been seven. Eight, something like that. Quite young. Back when seven and eight was young, not like now.
Well, it's
I think a 7 or 8 year old can handle this now.
Well, it's funny because that 7 or 8 would have been when I would have been 7 when I first saw this as well in 1979.
Did it scare you?
It didn't scare me. It transfixed me. You know what I mean? I was never really scared by Doctor Who when I was that age. I was just transfixed by it.
Do you remember when they put this out to the kids in DWM? Do you remember they took it to a school?
I was going to, yes. And I was actually living with Gary Gill at the time. I was flat sharing with Gary Gill at the time when he was doing this, or around that time. And that's when I was living in London. And I remember his excitement from the kids' reactions it must have been 96 then that he was doing that, if the dates line up. And yeah, I think we were also delighted about how that audience was absolutely... transfixed. But just that bit there, no, just the way Harry's no turns into the doctor's no on the phone, it's such a classic kind of cut, and there they are, and here is the cliffhanger.
And just that, the way it looms over the camera like that, and then straight in on the face,
and suddenly and done, and the music's building, and it's building in such a way, but then it's still a shock when it happens, and you know what's about to happen, but it's still a shock when it comes.
It's a skill, because I feel like as if every shot's been considered, but it flows like a piece of drama.
Yeah.
And this is being done at speed.
Absolutely.
Cheap.
Yes.
As well. You know, like, it has no right to be this good.
Although, well, look, remember, the filming or the recording takes place at speed, but the rehearsal, not so much. Remember, they've got all those days. I mean, I don't know how many days they have to have off filming for, you know, whatever's coming next. But getting the rehearsals right. And I think where... the classic series would come unstuck is the director thinking that they can do certain things in the studio. And then when they get to the studio, they go, oh my God, we can't possibly do that because the cameras are enormous and because of this and that, and there's a light here and so on. Whereas I think because Canfield knows the setup, but also because the actors are also perfectly, they know their stuff by the time they get into the studio, that they all just do it. And there's nothing actually, if you notice, despite the fact there's a lot of sort of tight shots and twos in twos and so on in what we've seen just now, there's nothing complicated. There's nothing that would have required a lot of setup. It was basically just about everyone hitting their marks as they were doing in the acting rehearsal rooms. So yeah, I mean, look, 10 out of 10, 11 out of 10 for that episode. I mean, you know, spectacular.
As an episode one, it's one of the best, I think.
It promises so much, and unlike so much other Doctor Who, it does actually keep delivering, I think, all the way through, despite some slightly dodgy effects in episode four, which we'll come to.